All right, this is KXFM. I'm Tyler Russell here in Laguna Beach, and this is actually my first moment back on the radio after a 3 or 4 month hiatus, and it's a pretty cool reason to do that. This is a special event we've been talking about for a couple weeks now, and we're really excited that it's finally happening. First of all, I'm joined in studio by Julie Lawton of Julie Lawton Design Build here in town. Hi, Julie. How are you?
Hello, everyone.
And we are on Zoom and on air at the same time with Kathy Valentine of the Go-Go's to talk about her brand new book, which is called All I Ever Wanted. I will hold that up. Kathy, how's it going?
Going good.
This is so cool.
Good.
Yeah, we're really, really excited to do this. We've got people both listening on air and tuning in on Zoom. And if you're only listening on air right now and you want to add the video component, we've actually all put on some clothes for this and gotten out of our COVID pajamas. So if you go to our player, kxfmradio.org/player, and click the banner right there on that, you can follow the Zoom link and you can watch this all unfold. So I want to start maybe, Julie, with a question for you. How the heck did this whole thing come together that we're doing right now before we dive in?
Well, you know me, I'm a female in a man's world of construction, and I was talking to my friends and one of my New York friends, and we got the idea of, you know, Kathy is in a woman in a man's world. It's historically a man's world. It's still a man's world. And what better to team up with a woman who succeeded in a man's world and done well and survived the 70s and 80s. I mean, just doing business at that time as a woman was tough, let alone expressing your talent. So I thought it was a brilliant way to share the love and show female power and share the love to other women and show anything's possible. That's basically what it is. These girls are true rock stars and they're true professionals. And when you do it right, it's kind of cool.
Yeah. Well, reading the book definitely gives you that impression. I don't know if folks tuning in have read it yet or not, but it really is. I mean, it says right in the back cover, somebody said it was the best rock memoir of all time. And I really think it's up there, Kathy. It's really, really good. So I guess first talk about, you know, when you got in your head that you were going to write a book. Maybe you had planned to all along from when you were 20, or maybe it was a more recent decision, and then how it came to be.
Yeah, it was definitely a more recent decision, although I've always been a writer. I've always kept journals. I've always done poetry. Obviously, I've always been a songwriter. But I started thinking I wanted to write a book about, gosh, 5, 6 years ago. And at first, I was messing around with short stories and the idea of a screenplay. And I just kind of wanted to transition from just being a musician. I've basically been in bands for almost 45 years. That's kind of been, and you know, other things too. I'm a mom and all kinds of other stuff, but career wise, it's always been in a band. I just wanted to branch out. And I just thought I had a story to tell. I thought there weren't enough women telling their stories that had been in music, you know? And I felt like I really wanted the focus to be a lot about the music as well as, you know, my childhood, which was rather unconventional and sometimes difficult, and my success. I told you I'd blabber on and on, so just hold up your hand if you want me to stop.
No problem.
You'll be like, oh, I might have a question in here. So anyway, I decided the memoir was a good story because it was my story. No one else could do it, and I thought it was compelling. So I went for it.
Yeah, I mean, and did you have any help writing it, or did you just sit down and tackle the whole thing?
Oh, God, no. I had no help at all. Of course, every writer that has a book deal has an editor when they, but you have to turn in the whole, you know, you have to turn it in. So I didn't have anyone help writing it, but I had people, you know, like copywriters that kind of caught any grammatical errors and things like that. And then I had a structural editor because the first version, I actually was skipping back and forth. Uh-huh. I would go 1971, 1981, 1970. So I was going back and forth, which I thought was brilliant, but my editor thought it was confusing and that people would have a hard time.
Well, that was what impressed me the most about the book. It was meticulous and in order, so it was flawlessly written, in my opinion, that way. So that was cool. I like that part about it. So that was,
thank you. And I did write it in a linear chronological fashion.
Right.
So it wasn't hard. Luckily, I didn't write it the back and forth way, but I had written it the other way. So it was really easy to go back to just a straight linear.
Well, you did do one piece of skipping around in the book, and that's how you opened it, which I thought was really cool, because you launched with the story of the first time you were invited to be in the Go-Go's. So would you briefly tell us that story backstage at the Whiskey, or in the bathroom at the Whiskey, I guess?
Yeah, and starting like that was a holdover from my back and forth method. And I said, I really think this is a strong starting place,
depends what perspective you're looking from. Yeah.
So yeah, the book starts, it's the prologue, and it's called Hullabaloo. And my titles for the chapters, I just generally yanked out of the book somewhere, out of the chapter, just thinking so I'd remember what it was about. But it talks about, I was, for the first time since I'd moved to LA as a teenager, 19 actually, and I wasn't in a band for a while, and I was a little bit like at odds, and like I hadn't not been a band in quite a while. So I didn't know what I was doing, and I ran into someone at the Whiskey, which is the famous club on Sunset Strip, and the band X was playing. I'm sure your listeners are really familiar with X, being like a California, like just iconic California band. But it was Christmas night. It was 1980. And I met Charlotte from the Go-Go's, and we didn't know each other formally. I certainly knew who they were because they were already starting to be popular. But she asked if I would substitute, and they had a show. My mind is still blown by this. They had four sold out nights, two shows a night at the Whiskey in 5 days from when I saw her. The first one was the 31st, 6 days. So as of 6 days before a four night engagement with two shows a night, they didn't know what they were going to do. So that cracks me up now, because we're so like into preparation now. But she said, can you play bass? I'm like, yeah, which I hadn't really played bass before. And I ran home that night. I borrowed a bass. I learned their songs. As I was learning the songs, I started thinking, this is such a good band. And I came to LA to make it. And I think this band is going to make it. And man, do I hope I get to stay. That's cool. Kind of the nutshell. I tell it a lot better in this story.
You do tell it excellently in the book, although that's a good synopsis. And I think what's funny, though, you didn't mention here, is that a year before, you had seen the Go-Go's for the first time at a club, I think it was in the Valley, and you didn't think they were very good.
Well, they were just starting out. So it wasn't that I didn't think they were good. I just thought they had a ways to go. Yeah. You know, when you're in your first band, and it was their very first band, except Charlotte has been in one band before. But so they just had a ways to go. That was my reaction to them. I was like, oh. And I thought I was like a big seasoned pro, because I had been to England and played in a band. I'd played in a couple bands in Texas. I had moved to LA and had done some cool stuff with my band, the Textones. So, you know, I thought I was just like further down the road. But that changed very quickly for them. They caught up.
Well, this is a question I want to ask both of you. Again, Kathy Valentine and Julie Lautner in studio with us here on KXFM. We're talking about Kathy's book, All I Ever Wanted. I'll just do a quick plug every once in a while. There was one particular person, and I'd like you to talk about her, that showed you that it was okay to be a rock star and be a girl. And I want you to talk about who that was. And then, Julie, maybe there was somebody in your childhood growing up that told you, hey, you know what? A girl can make it in a man's world. So, Kathy, you first.
Okay. I love this, because she is actually starting to get a lot of recognition now, finally. I think she's 72 or something. And I'm going to tell you the name at the end of the story. So all my heroes were guys in bands. All the bands I loved were guys. I was playing an acoustic guitar, but it never occurred to me that I could plug it in into an amp, get on stage and be like a rock star. Never entered my mind. But luckily, my mom's from England. We go to England. We're there. Again, it's Christmas. It's weird how these Christmas time time frames, like these big mind-blowing things happen. But I'm watching Top of the Pops, a really popular show in England, and this woman comes on stage. Okay, reveal. It's Susie Quattro. She's really known here as Leather Tuscadero from Happy Days. That kind of gets me a little irritated, because to me, she's a rock star, not a TV star. And she was huge in Europe and England and Australia, never quite made it here. But when I saw her, I said it was like an earthquake. It was like, oh, like my whole reality shifted. And from that moment on, I knew that what I wanted to do was go back home to Texas, find some like-minded girls my age and start a band.
Yeah.
So I'm very grateful to her. Oh, and we're friends now. Oh. And she has a documentary out, quick plug, great documentary. And we're trying to write a song together. So
oh, that's so cool.
The coolest part of your book for me was kind of rooting for you, rooting for your underdog story throughout. And when you make friends with the people, perhaps backstage, that you've idolized your whole career, that to me was like the big payoff. It was like, she did it. You know, I was rooting for you. That's cool.
That's a perk from making it.
Yeah. All right, Julie, who was your woman number one when you were younger?
Well, believe it or not, it was my mother, because when I was in high school, I was a drummer like her. I started at 10 years old, and I remember going off to college, and I had a boyfriend I was in love with, and she turned me around, grabbed me by the shoulders, and says, marriage is overrated. Focus on your career. And she said, you want to focus on your career, do what you need to do. And my sister and I were two girls with a dad who wanted a boy or two. So we were raised like boys. There was nothing we didn't do. There was no yard work we didn't do. I know how to lay concrete. I know how to ride a motorcycle. I know how to shoot a gun. There's nothing. My mom had her pilot's license. There's nothing they held us back on. So I was out the gate a feminist all the way from day one. And so it was easy for me. And I never thought any different. So when people looked at me funny and kind of gave me those sexist remarks, I just laughed and did better. So
there's
good.
Nobody that ever told you, you can't do this because you're a girl.
Oh, no. Even my grandma told me. I mean, my grandma was right there with my mom. We were out the gate, born in 1962. It was game on. And we never were held back, never told to learn how to cook, bake, or sew, even though I'm a gourmet cook from day one, because my grandpa was a chef. So I do all those things, but I was out the gate. Boom. Yeah. Nothing was going to hold me back. And I have the passion, like Kathy, I have a passion. I draw. That's my thing. I'm also a musician. If you think about it, I played piano, drums, and bass fiddle, but I gave that up and I don't play it much, but I still play my drums, but it's natural. But my focus was my art, my design, my drawing, my architecture. So I just went with it and it was fun.
Well, Kathy, this seems like a good time to ask you about your mom, because you sure have a unique and very interesting relationship with your mom in the book that you chronicle. Tell us a little bit about that and how it shaped you.
I still have a very interesting relationship with my mom. she's alive and well and a big part of my life. But I was just going to interject with what Julie said, too. I'm sure you remember in my book where I was a trim carpenter for a while.
Oh,
so
yeah,
I'm
going to
be coming to you, Julie, for a job.
That's right.
But this whole like writing thing doesn't work
you
out.
Can,
okay?
I know you can
you
do
know
it.
I can like.
I totally
put down
forgot
a,
about that when I read that. Yes, that was fascinating to me. And I thought, damn, there we go. Parallels. Yeah.
Yeah. And I also was a tomboy, too. I think it's interesting that, you know, that we both had some parallels. In
oh, yeah.
We,
there was no dresses, skirts, makeup.
And having a mother that kind of, my mom was single. So everything, you know, we didn't have a guy around the house. Everything she did herself. And, you know, I'm still like that. If the filters need changing, if this needs, you know, I figure it out. I fix it. But my mom was a single parent. I mean, a single mom. She was a UT student, University of Texas, and she had a full-time job and she was raising me and she was very young. And she was just kind of had a very unique kind of, I don't know, just approach to being a mom, which was basically like, you know, this is a person. My job is to love them. My job is to feed them, make sure they have a good place to live. The rest they'll figure out. So that was kind of her approach. It was really important to me to tell the truth. And I talked to her about everything I wrote in the book. I asked her, are you okay with this? Because it all happened. And she was very supportive. Like even when it meant that people were going to read what I wrote and say, oh my God, I can't believe a mom would do that. It was more important to her that I tell my story and tell it truthfully. And if I felt it was important to the context, you know, she wasn't going to stand in the way of that. So she's very brave and she's very supportive, always supportive. She wasn't there in a lot of ways where I needed guidance, boundaries, but she was always supportive. So I love my mom dearly. And I would have had a really boring book if she'd been any different.
That might be true.
That's true.
I don't want to get too much into the details of some of those harder subjects that you talk about. I do want people to read the book, and I think you explain it in a really meaningful, heartfelt way that often teaches the reader something. So I don't want to do it injustice by trying to talk about it now, but I do want to ask in general, how did some of those kind of tragic things also shape who you ended up becoming?
Well, I think it was more like they played a big part of me, acting like everything's okay when it's not, because I felt as a child like if I wasn't okay, that my mom wouldn't be able to handle it. So everything, I was kind of just wired from a young age to be very responsible, to act like everything was okay even when it wasn't, and also to keep the feelings down. I think I turned to, I enjoyed the feeling of drugs or alcohol because it kind of helped keep that. And it made me very like a joker, like, you know, always wanting to be up and making people laugh and stuff. So it all the pain of my childhood played a big part in good ways and bad ways. It made me very driven to achieve so I could feel like I mattered. My dad wasn't in my life. And I think at my core, I felt like I just didn't matter that much or else he would be there for me more. So it made me very ambitious. So in a lot of good ways and some negative ways, it shaped me.
Yeah. I do want to mention your dad briefly because there's, I think, a pretty pivotal moment in your guitar learning and your career starting where he sends you a letter because you asked him, you know, basically to help you buy a guitar and an amp. And he said, no, girls don't do that sort of thing. So how did that make you feel at the time?
Well, I felt like he just didn't know me. He didn't understand me. I'd never asked for anything. My dad wasn't hurting for money back then when my parents first split up. He was a student putting himself through graduate school. But by the time I asked him for something, he was a professor and he had a family. And I just felt like I'd never asked for anything. So give me this. Mm-hmm. That was the way I felt. And he's very conventional. You know, he felt like, no, that's not what something does. He was very practical and he was a self-made man and got out of his own poverty with an education. And the idea of me not going to college was probably like the worst thing he could imagine. Mm-hmm. Although he didn't feel like he had a say in anything because he wasn't there raising me.
Yeah. Did you aim to prove that statement wrong? Was that kind of like ringing in the back of your head?
No, I wasn't that. He wasn't enough a part of my life enough, you know, and I didn't even realize until we were successful and he was at a show and he was like, he was so proud of me. And he said, I was wrong. You've done really great. I've got my Go-Go's records right next to my Merle Haggard.
Yeah, I loved that.
It wasn't then until then that I even realized what I had missed out on by not having a dad. Like I never knew that feeling of being a little girl and having your dad just like be really proud of you. And like, just kind of, you know, there's something about daddy's old princess and I never knew what that was.
Yeah.
And, that was the first time in my life. And it was a very, very visceral moment because like most of the time it was party on the tour bus after the show. And that night it wasn't party on the tour bus for me. It was like go in my bunk and cry.
Mm. Yeah. I do want to ask another question for both of you. And this is probably one of the bigger overview questions of this whole thing is, you know, we've talked a little bit about there not being many female role models to make it as a musician at that time. Perhaps, Julie, for you, there weren't a lot of female role models in now what you do. Today, there are more. But do you feel that now, you know, 30, 40 years later, have we made enough strides? Had we made all the strides necessary for a young girl to think she can grow up and be a rock star or anything? Or is there still more work to be done? And if there is more work to be done, what more do we need to do for young girls?
Kathy?
Well, I think that the patriarchy is still very alive and well and thriving. I especially feel like until like women are in positions like in the government and making policy and stuff, that there's always going to be a bit of an inequality. But, you know, I always say that like young girls now, they have been exposed so much more than I was. And if I could have the determination without all the exposure, then I'm sure that it's any girl that decides she wants to be a musician isn't going to say, look around like I did and not have seen it. I mean, young girls now, there's tons of musicians. They see at every concert. They see females in the band. They see even the Barbies and the dolls have and all that. They grow up with the, like Nick and Disney and all those people. All those girls are like rock stars. So I think that there's exposure, and it's really kind of what you want to do with your life is, you know.
Yeah.
I don't think women in general are encouraged to go into the sciences as much, into the typical masculine supposed fields.
And, yeah.
So I guess as we just keep seeing more and more, that there will be more and more.
Well, that's a good transition to you, Julie. I can't imagine you feel that many women are encouraged to be general contractors or construction workers or anything like that. So how do we break that barrier?
Well, it's funny because I'm hoping that people will see you can do it. It's easy and it's rewarding because most women choose not. They choose to stay in the interior design or they're in architecture, but they don't do that jump because they're afraid it's a boys club, like a football team, like you really can't join. Like it's forbidden in a way. It's taboo. So my business, God, it was a piece of cake and it's the best thing I ever did. But you can tell women shy away from it because it is a lot of work, too. It's like hardcore. I mean, a lot of focus. But I think like my idol, my only inspiration was Julia Morgan, the architect for Hearst Castle, the first female architect. And she built it. So she did what I do, but nobody has sense like that, an icon like that, because either the woman's an architect or there's very few engineers and there's like two or three contractors. So it's not paved well enough, but it's doable. So now we're both examples of that, and we're like 60. And, you know, we started this a long time ago, and some women, like, I'll be dead before someone has a career like mine or even starts one. You know, that's the sad part. So it's like, but Kathy's has more people in her world, but mine is, there's not enough. So.
Yeah. And I think there need to be more men. I mean, I'm one who acknowledge that a female touch, for lack of a better word, in a position of power, like you said, would be a good thing, you know, for a lot of people, even for men. I've got a coffee cup that says feminist on it, so I'm allowed to say this. And my wife gave it to me, and I have a 1-year-old daughter, so I'm on your guys' team, and I agree with you. Although there are more examples, you know, in Barbie dolls and in TV and in media, there's still not enough reality, I think, of women in power. So I agree with you on that, Kathy.
Yeah,
I think there's another problem is that, like, you know, if a woman decides to start a family, you know, she's at a real disadvantage. I mean, I started my family very late in life, and I had enough success that when I had a young child, I could go on the road and I could bring a nanny, and it was worlds colliding, but it was doable.
Yeah.
If I was in a van trying to play around, well, I don't know what I would do. And I think, you know, a guy can be 30 years old and still slogging around the country trying to make it in his van and still have a kid, you know, because probably it's going to be the mom that he leaves it. So I think that's a problem too.
Yeah.
And women are always put in that box of the motherhood, the wife, and raising children. And you get stuck with that because they always assume that's what you're going to do. And then when you don't, like, I didn't get married all happily until I was 50, and I have no regrets. And I, you know, so the point is you're always put in that box, like, oh, why didn't you have kids? And I'm like, jeez.
Have you guys seen that that documentary F is for Father about all the punk rockers who go on the road and they grow up and be dads? It's all like the early 2000s punk bands. Have you seen that, Kathy?
No, I haven't. That sounds good.
Yeah, pretty good. We watched it on Father's Day, but it's true. I mean, they can do it and their wives are stuck at home with the kids. It doesn't go both ways. So I think that's a really good point. All right, just a reminder of what we're doing here. Kathy Valentine's on Zoom and on the air. We're talking about her book. It's called All I Ever Wanted. It's her new memoir. Julie Lawton's here as well from Julie Lawton Design Build. If you're listening on the radio, you can also join us on Zoom by clicking the banner that's right there on the player, and you can watch us talk as well. I wanted to talk about one more thing on kind of the growing up as a girl in the rock industry. I found something really interesting you said in the book. You said people in the business, like fellow players, fellow band members, other people in the scene, they didn't really disrespect women. They didn't really care. It was like, could you play or not? That's all that mattered. It was more the audience and maybe the management that you had to change the perception of at the time. Will you talk a little bit about that?
Well, not so much audience and management. I mean, at times the audience, but, you know, I was fortunate in most of my bands, the audience was there to see the band and knew what they were going to get. But I would say more, we faced a lot of sexism in radio programming, media a little bit. A lot of times the media, the press felt, seemed to be kind of dismissive or wanting to, you know, figure out what box we belonged in, you know. But the musicians, and this is my experience, and several other women I've talked to, the musicians that were men were, from the very beginning when I was first starting to play, all the way up to, you know, even still, just so supportive, you know. Always, I've always felt like the guy musicians were there on my side, rooting for me.
Yeah. Speaking of being put in a box, I would love if you would tell the story of you getting on Rolling Stone for the first time and the way that photo shoot evolved and how that made you guys feel.
Well, you have to understand that Rolling Stone was huge. I mean, it was as big as it had ever been. And being on the cover of Rolling Stone was a hallmark of having made it and of success. And the Go-Go's got to be on there twice. But the first time, we were thrilled. We were shooting the cover. We had a very famous photographer doing it, and we had all gotten all dressed up with our makeup. And the next thing you know, the photographer, Annie Leibovitz, her assistants came and brought all this like bags of stuff and dumped it on the floor. And it was like all these Hanes packages of T-shirts and underwear and bras, and, well, we want you to wear this. And we're like, no, we're dressed. We're good. No. I think you should do it. No, we're good. I think you should just try it. No, we're good. And anyway, back and forth until we're like, okay, we'll try it. And that's, of course, what got used. And it was kind of hard, but the hardest part was the headline that they put on alongside our cover, which was Go-Go's Put Out, which in my book I write, it just felt a little kind of like a put down. It felt kind of like, it wasn't like, I don't know, it just felt too cute and put down-ish. Yeah. So that was a drag.
And there was like this combination of feelings you felt of having been so excited to finally make it on the cover of Rolling Stone and be a little dismayed by the decision they made for you guys, for your image.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's like, you know, you have to weigh it. It's like, what are you going to do? Storm out and go, no, we're not going to be on the cover. And the way in our mind, you know, this, the photographer was a huge, you know, huge. I mean, you look up to these people, you look up to the institution, and you're just a young band trying to make it. So there's definitely compromises along the way. And I think that felt like a compromise, you know. It felt more important to be on Rolling Stone and to walk out with your integrity.
Yeah.
But also, we felt like maybe, because it wasn't like super hypersexualized underwear, you know, it was kind of very, it was the wholesome kind, which might've been part of the thing, like, oh, the wholesome band, you know, let's put them in the wholesome underwear. So I know we would have never, if it had been a bunch of like garter belts and stockings and corsets, I'm pretty sure that would not happen.
You probably never would have put those on in the first place.
No, I don't think that would have happened. Yeah. So that's kind of, I don't know where the line is drawn, but who knows, long time ago.
I think for me in the book, that was definitely one of the moments where you guys really made it. There's a lot of others. So I'm wondering, in your memory, is there a defining moment in your career, especially with the Go-Go's, where you felt, okay, I've really made it now?
Well, as I wrote in the book, I really tried to bring the reader along with me. And I like to tell people that might not know this, that you don't have to be a Go-Go's fan to enjoy this book. You don't even have to know who I am. I think you're going to like it because it really is a very human story. But my biggest goal was to get the feelings on the page so that my reader felt like they were kind of along for the ride. And so they really knew what it felt like. I loved writing about the things that were exciting and just really getting back. I didn't even start typing or writing until I was feeling it again. But for me, you have to understand, every little stage was making it. To me, like just number one, oh, I'm in a band and I don't have a day job and people like the band and we can sell out the club. I've made it. Oh, we're going to make a record in New York City and stay in a hotel for 2 months. Who gets to do that? Oh, we've made it,
yeah.
You know, and oh, we get to go on tour and every place we play, every city we pull into, Atlanta, Detroit, Minneapolis, you know, wherever we go, it's a club and it's sold out. That felt like we made it. So every little incremental thing that hadn't happened before felt like making it to me.
Yeah.
But if you really want, you know, the crystallized one for me that always really stood out was headlining Madison Square Garden, looking out and just having my mind blown that we were headlining Madison Square Garden.
That's huge.
And that everybody was on their feet dancing and to us. And we're just five, like 23, 24 year olds that are playing our songs.
Yeah.
And it was cool.
And you had been there before opening. I can't remember for whom. Who did you open
for? The Police. Yeah, we'd right. opened for the Police.
Yeah. And then you got to headline it. I think one thing that amazed me about you, and maybe Julie, you can speak to this too. In the book, it seems like you never don't think you're not going to be successful. Like from day one, when you picked up the guitar, you knew I'm going to be a rock star. And then you went to LA and I'm going to be a rock star. And no matter how hard it was at times, you still thought, well, yeah, I'm going to make it. It's almost like you never even doubted that you would. And I want you to talk a little bit about why that perseverance is so necessary to make it in anything. And Julie, if you could touch on that too after mm-hmm. Kathy.
Yeah, I don't know if it was just youthfulness or what, but I had no doubt. And I still think even if I hadn't found the Go-Go's, I would have found something. That's how strong of a drive it was. And I don't know if it's just kind of being young or what. I still tend to think I could put, you know, with the limitations of my age, put, you know, whatever I put my mind to, I can do. And I think a lot of it was my mom always saying, you know, you can do whatever you want. You can do it. And I don't know. I don't know what it was, but I did feel very driven. And I felt like was never one of those people that felt like I didn't deserve it. You know what yeah. I mean? Like you hear like people write their memoirs and they're like, oh, I felt like a phony. I felt like I didn't deserve it. I wasn't worthy. I didn't feel like that. I felt like I was exactly where I was supposed to be.
Yeah. And you even address at times when you're not the best player in the room, when you get replaced in certain bands and you go there and you're still not even swayed by your success, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, it's an old cliche, but you know, you're going to get knocked down a lot and you just got to get up and keep going. And I tend to be just very stubborn and focused. I mean, if I hear no, and take this out of the whole Me Too thing, I don't mean it like this, but if I hear the word no, it doesn't register. I'm like, okay, well, I better ask them. And then they say no. Okay, well, I'm going to ask them. And then they say, like, I have to hear no like so many times before I'm like, and then I just go, oh, I didn't want it anyway.
Yeah.
And kind of the same way.
Yeah, Julie, can you relate to that idea?
Well, it's kind of the same thing because whether you know it or not, I think, because you have this thing in your head because you are projecting whether you know it or not because that's how you kind of see yourself. Because I was like this artist, I can draw anything. It was weird. I was drawing like buildings when I was like 10. I mean, I had this ability. So when I got my first jobs, it was always this competition with myself to do better. And I just rolled with it because then people saw my talent, more people saw the talent, then you get more jobs. And all of a sudden I'm working with the top five developers in New York City. Bam, I made it in New York City at 28 years old. Done. End of story. Okay, and then I come to California. But the passion was never doubted me because that's what I was eternally. That's my talent. And I stayed with my drive and my talent. I never wavered to take a break to get married or take a break to have kids or focus on, you know, stuff. I focused on what was in my, you know, belly, the fire in my belly type thing. That was my passion, my artistic talent. And that was it. So, and I just always saw myself as this artist, well, architectural artist. And it just always, because you're projecting. I think that's the key is when you project it. So if you really want something, you just project it because what you think becomes words and words become things. So there you go.
Well, it also helps that you're literally the hardest worker I've ever met.
Julie's
up at like 3 or 4 in the morning every day. She'll immediately respond to anything anybody ever needs. So, I mean, nobody's like you as well. So you've got some weird gene in there.
It's driven. I don't know. It's the Irish, German, English background.
I also want to just back you up on that. I am a big like visualizer. In fact, you have to.
Yeah.
If I can't see it clearly in my mind, that's when I doubt it. That's when I think maybe that's not for me.
I see everything. I plan everything. Yeah. I plan that, you know, I plan tonight. What were we talking about? I went over 10 options and, you know, everything's visualized in advance. Trust me. And then I can
wait. Me too. I visualize every time before I go on a tour, I visualize what I'm going to wear, what I'm going to be like. Mm-hmm. I just see it very clearly. And I did that with my book. I mean, I used to go any bookstore I walked into, I went to up to the shelf. And I just looked right where my book was going to be, and I just pictured my book, my name on that shelf.
If you don't do that, it doesn't happen, because you got to make it happen. That's what other people don't realize, because when you're young, you think, who's going to save me? Who's going to help me? Who's my knight in white knight and shining armor? Well, ladies, there isn't one. It's you. And that's all I can tell you for real in all aspects of life, personal and professional. It's you. People will be there for you to help you always, and there's stepping stones along the way. Nick, knock down, stand up, but it's you.
Well said. Kathy, there's a moment in the book for me where I thought perhaps this is what it feels like to make it, and that's when you got to open for the Stones. And you talk in the beginning of the book about how much you idolize them, how you think they're the greatest band ever. You know, you love Mick, you love Keith's guitar playing. You know, he's your idol. And then you open for him. So tell us about being backstage at that concert and meeting Mick Jagger.
Well, you know, the Stones did, it was the first tour they'd done in a while where they were picking bands that were kind of up and coming all across the country. I think they got Prince and they got the Stray Cats and we got picked. And I was like freaking out. It was like all of us were, but I think I might have been freaking out more than the others. maybe Gina was freaking out as much as me. But it was the biggest thrill that I could even imagine. And I really felt like anything could happen. I thought, if I can be playing in a club in L.A., you know, a year ago, and then opening for the Stones, anything can happen. I was wandering around, like I really desperately wanted to meet them. I did get to meet on that show. We got to meet Bill and Charlie and Mick.
the other one. Yeah.
The guy, that old singer guy. but I didn't get to meet Keith, who was my big hero. But that happened another time, so it was all right.
Was meeting him another time? You don't address it in the book, but was that particularly eventful, meeting him for the first time?
Oh, I do talk about it in the book.
Oh, I must have missed that.
Yeah, I meet him in New York City when they're doing Steel Wheels. And it was like, I literally, when I left the studio where I met him, I was like, okay, that's it. Not that I could die now, not that kind of, that's it. But it was like, I don't know, it was a great thing. And he didn't let me down at all. He was just so down to earth and awesome and cool.
Yeah.
Very cool.
Well, we're talking a little bit about kind of the height of the Go-Go's career and kind of when they were, you know, first getting to play these huge venues and tour with big bands. And I think maybe it's a good time, Kathy, for you to read the passage of the book that you identified. I don't know if you want to set it up for us a little bit. And
we
then,
have time?
Yeah, we have time for sure.
All right. This is the book again, everybody. And I was asked to read. This is actually the first time I've done this. So y'all are special. I normally don't read at all. But this is, the Go-Go's were opening for The Police, which is one of the biggest bands in the world back then. And we'd done it in Europe and we've moved on to America. So we were playing arenas for the first time and it was pretty awesome. But they were huge and we were still up and coming. And one night, I'll just dive in. You got your backstory. The Police graciously offered to let us join them on a private plane after a concert in Denver to the next city. An unsettling premonition crept into my heart. I couldn't shake it. All through the set, I worried and tried to rationalize away the bad feeling. Our crew packed up our equipment. They wanted to get started. It was a 13-hour drive. While the rest of my band watched The Police, I made a decision to ride with the crew, and I left. Better safe than in a plane crash, I thought, as if Patsy Cline and Buddy Holly were sitting on my shoulders, wagging their fingers at my imagination. The idea of something bad happening and the last thought of my life being, I knew I shouldn't have flown, had gripped me. Riding on the crew bus was a drag, with me sleepless and wedged into the luggage bunk. At least I'll be alive, I thought, trying to conjure up a small, smug comfort. Rolling in at noon and seeing our tour manager in the lobby, I knew immediately that everyone had arrived alive and well. They'd made the trip in two-hour food and drinks, luxe, private jet style. On the way to soundcheck, the band made sure I heard every detail of what I'd missed. Yeah, I'm an idiot, I said, annoyed with the stupid hunch that had kept me off a freaking private plane with the police. I go on to talk about, this is the last show with the police, so I talk about that. It's really fun because it's the last show of the tour. Everyone was in a great mood. The police invited us on their plane again to fly to Los Angeles from Phoenix, home in an hour instead of the long drive, and a second chance to fly on the private jet. Absolutely. Carousing and talking, both bands rode together to the private airstrip. I wish it had been like this the whole time, relaxed and hanging out. The group settled into the plane, no waiting, no lines. Normal flying sucks, I thought. We rolled down the runway, picking up speed. Fire, Sting yelled. There's a fire on the wing. Sure enough, out the window, flames whipped in the wind. Panic ensued. The plane rolled to a stop and the door opened. Belinda, that's our lead singer, went into full-on survival mode and shoved everyone out of the way, trampling over go-go's and police like furniture to be the first one off the plane. For decades, it made us laugh when recalling the story, and I lamented my sense of intuition and premonition, which obviously had a broken timer.
Great. I love it. That's one of my favorite parts of the book. Has that happened to you again later in life where you premonition something horrible and it happened the day later? Or anything? Is that the only time?
God, I hope not. It's weird. Premonitions are weird because, you know, you get bad, creepy feelings sometimes. Mm-hmm. And you're like, you don't know whether to go with it or not. I mean, like, what if you're going to the airport, you're getting on a plane and you get I've had that happen where I'm like, oh, I gotta go. But I never do, you know? So
yeah,
I definitely get this creepy, like, but I don't usually follow through.
Well, we've got about 12 minutes left of this interview, and I want to invite some people who are either watching on Zoom or listening on KXFM to type us a question or two, and we'll chat with Kathy a little longer, and then at the end, we'll get to some of those questions. So again, on the Zoom chat, you can just type right there what you want to ask Kathy, or you can text us. Our phone number is 949-715-KXFM. That's 715-5936. You know, one more thing I wanted to ask you, Kathy, and we're kind of transitioning out of the Stones and the police. What effect did the combination of your co-British and American upbringing have on you wanting to be a rock star and then ultimately being successful? Because you really cut your teeth in the London scene as well at some point in your teenage years. So talk a little bit about that.
Well, I think what was crucial was that, again, I had some very painful things happen as an adolescent, which, you know, adolescence is hard anyway, even when it's idealized. So to have painful things happen, and you'll have to read the book to I don't want to go into all that stuff now because we'll all be sad. I'm losing my train of thought. Oh, yeah. So the one saving thing was that my mom was English and we would go to England sometimes, and it helped so much because getting away from that world that seemed like so, like I felt like a pariah. I really didn't feel, not only did I feel like I didn't fit in, I felt like I was targeted a lot. And I don't mean bullied. I mean like just people taking advantage and spreading bad stories about both me and my mom. And going to England really made the world like, okay, there's so much more to the world than where I am and what I'm going through now. It was so helpful. And it made me feel more like I could come back with, it gave me confidence. I think traveling is so good for just, you know, feeling like a well-rounded person in terms of having an awareness of other cultures and other people and the way they talk and the way they eat and the way they live their lives. So I would come back to America feeling, you know, kind of more confident. And that might have played a small part in my believing in myself, too.
By the way, I don't know how I just noticed a very patient dog behind you. Is that a dog?
Is that Tux? Oh yes, he's stealing my thunder.
I don't know if he's been there the whole time, or if he just showed up, or if he's under that pillow, or what. But
I know he looks like he's dead. Don't worry, he's alive.
I did want to ask you while we're on the subject. Can you tell us a little bit about what's behind us? The four guitars you have on the wall behind us. Where are we in your house?
Next to the Go-Go's poster, there's a black Strat, which figures it's a character in my book. I write a lot about that guitar. Uh-huh. It's actually my first cool guitar I got. My first guitar was okay. When I saw that one, I just fell in love, and I knew it was my guitar. And I've had it all this time, and played a lot of gigs. Keith Richards actually has played that guitar, yeah. And that happened uh-huh. in the 2000s. But oh no, that happened in the 90s. So I'm going to tell people too, this book goes from 1970 to 1990. It's a memoir. It's a slice of life. The guitar next to it is a Les Paul, my first Les Paul. And then I've got a Rickenbacker 12 string. And then I have a super cool silver sparkle Tele that matches the bass. I have a bass that's exactly like that I play in the Go-Go's. And that was a present from Bill. I feel like such a name dropper, but that was a present from Billy Gibbons of ZZ Top.
Cool.
Oh,
and
he
designed the bass for me, and then he sent me that one.
Yeah, so. I loved when you introduced ZZ Top, to all your London friends when you were over there, and they didn't know him yet. That was
I
cool.
know, and they still play that. They still play that song, Girls School Does.
Yeah. All right, so I want to get to a couple viewer questions or listener questions. Deborah says that we should talk a little bit about the soundtrack for the book and also the audiobook. So will you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes, the book is out on audio, and I'm so thrilled because I wrote a soundtrack to this book, and I feel like it's a very unnoticed part of it, and it's an innovative and creative thing to do, to put a soundtrack to a book. It was very freeing and fun and exciting, and just really, I loved making the soundtrack to the book, and it's completely derived from the book. And you can get that on all the streaming platforms, or you can buy the audio book, which also has the soundtrack alongside it with some underscoring too. So yeah, it's a super cool, I thought it would get a lot more attention because it's such a different idea that very few people have done, but it's basically a solo album, but it's like does whatever it wants to because it's a soundtrack.
That's really cool. So I don't, forgive me for not knowing this, but do you narrate the audiobook?
Yes.
Okay.
I do the audiobook, and on the soundtrack, I wrote everything and performed it and produced it with Michael Rouse, a producer in New York City.
Really cool.
So I'm really proud of it.
All right. Well, Erica chimed in on Zoom. She said, hi, Kathy. Who are some of your favorite female bands and musicians?
I really like the Beaches. They're from Toronto. They really remind me of the Go-Go's when we were that age. They're such a good band. They're doing really well. They don't really need my hype. I like Haim. I think they're a super band.
Yeah.
I really like when they rock out. There's video of them on YouTube, like, just totally rocking out like mad. I wish they did that more. I love a lot of musicians. In Austin, we've got a bunch of them. I like X-Hex, and I loved a lot of the bands have gone that I liked. I loved Elastica and the Donnas. And so I just think there's been tons of great female bands, everyone, and musicians from the Breeders and Birth Assault and all these bands from the 90s, Bikini Kill, all the Riot Girl bands. And up until now, there's so many,
Yeah. Do we know if any all female band has usurped you guys in terms of charts or record sales? No. Okay. Do you want somebody to at some point?
The commercial success of the Go-Go's and the Bangles has not quite been matched. Although I think Haim could do it. I think they're probably selling lots of records.
Yeah. All right. A few people asked about some of the kind of the new things going on with the Go-Go's. We've got a documentary coming out next month, a new single, which was a big surprise. So tell us a little bit about, and someone asked, will there be a tour in 2021? So you want to give us a little Go-Go's update?
Yeah, there's a doc. Well, I think they know it. And you just said it. There's a documentary and there's a new song coming out all on July 31st is the premiere. It was August 1st, so I didn't make a mistake. If anyone thinks I didn't made a mistake, I didn't. It's July 31st.
All right.
And the single is called Club Zero. And I think there's a tour, but, you know, we don't, the world is pretty, like, we don't know what's happening, but we're ready to go play. If people are, can go
awesome.
To a concert, you know, we'll do it.
And then maybe we can squeeze in a couple more here. Deborah said, having a little time to reflect, has there been anything surprising to you or something you have learned during your virtual book tour?
Yes. And that's a great question. I, you know, think about when you go to a therapist, you talk, they ask you questions and you answer them and then you get insights. So I feel like I've almost been in therapy. I've done so many interviews and with all different types of people. I've really enjoyed it. And I have gotten a lot of insights and I've learned a lot. And the main thing I think, and this goes more to writing the book, but I really started to realize that my time, that I really want to put my focus and my effort and my energy in being Kathy Valentine for a while, because when I put that focus and energy and effort into something, it's enormous. And I've always done it for bands. I've always done it for the greater good. And I do a lot. I'm not necessarily in the spotlight or up front, but I'm doing a hell of a lot. And I feel like I want to just do that for me for a while. And I want to do more music on my own. And I want to write more books. And I was going to do a 23-city tour. I would have been in your town at a bookstore or in your studio, and we would have been doing this face to face if it wasn't for the pandemic. And I was really excited about getting out and just being me and connecting with people and doing songs and telling stories and having it be super interactive. And I hope I get a chance to do that.
Yeah, this is as close as we can get right now, unfortunately. And then, you know, we're going to go in a couple minutes here, but Julie, I want to have you do some parting words for us. Talk a little bit about your business and how people can find you. And then just maybe one more quick plug to young women, just kind of bringing it back home.
Well, as a woman in construction and the design build world, I can tell you that if you want to do it, you can do it, because the road has been paved and there's nothing you can't do as a woman today. So the door is open. It just, you have to put your mind to it. And it's the like I said, the road is paved, but my business is pretty much on fire because we're essential workers, because you can't leave a house, you know, in torn up. So we're busy. So I've been working like crazy, and I have a couple projects in Laguna, a couple in Newport and Balboa Peninsula. So I can always be reached at 714-305-2861 locally, of course. But you see my trucks everywhere and my signs, so it's been fun. And like I said, I'm always busy and just part of the fabric of the builder community. So,
and your website?
My website is Julie at julielawton.com. Sorry, Julie, just my name, julielawton.com. I'm so bad.
Awesome. And then, Kathy, you know, we haven't talked very much about your daughter. I'd like to for a moment. You know, what sorts of things do you teach her? And what sorts of things do you notice her embodying that gives you hope for the next generation of women?
Well, she's very engaged, very, very excited to vote in the next election. Taking this pandemic like a, you know, it's really hard for a 17-year-old. You know, she was going to be a senior in high school and captain of her dance team, and all kinds of amazing stuff was supposed to be happening for her in this last year.
Yeah.
So she's taking it very well, and she's smart and creative, and I just love her to bits. And she's doing a lot of music, so I'm really, and I never ever pushed that. It was all on her own. She's taught herself guitar. She's writing her own songs. Oh. We just did a road trip, and we recorded with her dad, who's also musical. We recorded two songs with her, and she doesn't want music to be her career, but she's just creative and likes doing
wow,
it.
So that's nice.
I think that her generation is going to be, I think they know that they're getting a really raw deal, and they're kind of chomping at the bit to have their say about things.
Yeah. Awesome. All right, one last time. This is the book. It's called All I Ever Wanted. It's by Kathy Valentine, who's been so kind to join us on Zoom and over the air for the last hour. Where do you want people to go to pick it up, by the way? What's the best thing to do virtually right now?
Well, I've been supporting the indie bookstores because I don't think we have to worry about Amazon going out of business.
Yeah.
But all those wonderful bookstores that we like to go to are really struggling. So it might take a little bit longer, but I like to say my book has a long shelf life and it's not going anywhere. And support indie bookstores, you know, if you have one in your town, or if there's not one in your town, support one in another town, and just go on their website and order it. And a lot of them have signed books for me. And so, I don't know.
It is for sale here at Laguna Beach Books in town.
No, it's at Sleepless in Seattle, the brand new bookstore at the corner of PCH and Bluebird. It's right across from the Surf and Sand. They're new in town, so go support them. The book's in the window. There's 10 signed copies. They're brand new. They came from the Midwest. They just opened their store, and they're doing well during COVID. And they already sold one of your books, Kathy. They sold one yesterday.
Oh, that's awesome. Well, remember I was saying how I would go imagine my book on the bookshelf? I only got to do that for the first time a couple of weeks ago because you couldn't. I finally went into a bookstore and like there it was. Because the whole time it's been out, it's been, you know, things were shut down. But I want to say also about Julie's stuff. I went on her website because I did my homework before I did this. And you are amazing. And I need to sell lots of books so I can hire you to build me a house.
That's right. Let's get on it. It's cheaper to build in Texas, let me tell you.
I see a few Zoomers are holding up their copy of their book. And I will mention, you know, we have a few signed copies here at the radio station that we're cleared to give away.
Yes, you are.
So here's what I'm going to say. Again, if you'll text us at 949-715-5936. That's 949-715-KXFM. We will give a few of these away to, we'll select a few people randomly. It's best if you're local to Southern California and can pick it up, but if you can't, we'll figure something out and we'll get it over to you. So, Kathy, I think that's it from us. And we're just really, really grateful to have the opportunity to do this with you. And Julie, thank you so much for putting two and two together and making this happen.
It was my pleasure. And I really love this. It was wonderful.
Awesome. Any last words, Kathy?
I love it too. Thank you so much.
All right. Great. And we'll have this, we have this recording available, and we'll have a podcast of this on our website as well, which is kxfmradio.org for people to consume and share after the fact. So Kathy Valentine of the Go-Go's, author of All I Ever Wanted. That should come first now. Kathy Valentine, author, musician. thank you so much. I really, really appreciate you.
Thank you. You were great.
All right. Thanks a lot. Bye-bye.